This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we hear from Nathan Fuller, head of the Julian Assange Defense Committee, to give us an update on that case.
Well, it's an absolute bombshell, Jim. It turns out that Mike Pompeo, who was the head of the CIA, wanted to have Julian Assange kidnapped, rendered, and assassinated.
Then we will also speak with attorney Marjorie Cohn on the fate of Roe v. Wade in the upcoming Supreme Court term.
Marjorie knows quite a lot about the threat to the abortions. She's written two articles for Truth Out. It's good to have her on as our guest, not just as our co-host.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
This is Jim Lafferty. I'm the Executive Director Emeritus of the National Lawyers Guild in Los Angeles and the host of the Lawyers Guild show on sister station KPFK. Shortly, I'm set to become one of the hosts on the wonderful show I'm now giving you this editorial on, Law and Disorder. The title of this editorial is, With Military Actions in 159 Countries, America is Now the World's Police Force. A couple of weeks ago, President Joe Biden stood before the General Assembly of the United Nations and said that, and I quote, for the first time in 20 years, the United States is not at war. We've turned the page, close quote. Well, his statement was a damnable lie. A damnable lie with respect to Afghanistan, where our troops may be gone, but where our bomber planes and bomber drones are still dropping their deadly payloads on the people and buildings in Afghanistan, and a damnable lie with respect to a shocking number of other countries where the United States is engaged in some form of military action. Biden admitted as much when, in June, he sent a letter to Congress listing all of the countries where U.S. troops are waging war against groups opposed by the United States. And according to the journal Conflict Management and Peace Science, the United States has 173,000 military troops engaged in conflicts in 159 other nations. Hell, it's hard to find a country where U.S. troops are not engaged in some form of military action, be it in the Middle East, Asia, Africa, or South America. Now, I know, that's really hard to believe, but think about it. There are over 40,000 U.S. troops just in the Middle East, 2,500 of them in Iraq, more than 18 years after George Bush first attacked Iraq. 900 troops are in Syria. Drones are dropping bombs in Pakistan and in, well, far, far too many other countries to list today. And whether we are in these countries as hired guns or uninvited interventionists, we are there without the general knowledge of the American people, and a great deal of what we are doing there constitute war crimes. Of course, we don't hear much about these too numerous to mention U.S. military operations, since so many of them are done under what is known as CIA Covert Action Authority. Let me say it again. There are 159 countries experiencing some form of U.S. military action. Maybe you remember that once upon a time in America, there was a real debate underway as to whether America should be the policeman of the world. Mind you, the debate was seldom over whether we had the right to police the world, as opposed to whether we should police the world. Well, my friends, that debate has long been over. Because America is, without a doubt, the world's police force now. And it does not play this role to ensure a peaceful world. No, it plays it to ensure a profitable world for capitalist corporate America, which jumps at every chance to profit from the production of the weapons of war. And what does the fact of us policing the world to make it safe for corporate America tell us about our recent presidents, Bush, Clinton, Obama, Trump, and now Biden? Well, since the civilian deaths from this almost unimaginable litany of illegal military actions has caused millions of deaths and many more millions of ruined lives and destroyed infrastructure, it tells us that these presidents are war criminals. In Biden's case, his war crimes continue with no end in sight. And since the lion's share of those deaths have taken place in Muslim countries, it tells us as well that the United States has, for at least 20 years now, been waging a war of genocide against the Muslim world. This in turn got me thinking about the U.S. prison on Guantanamo. At its peak, it held close to 900 Muslim men and children, and held them for years and years, in most cases with no real charges ever being brought against them. Today, there are only about 40 of those poor men still stuck in Guantanamo prison. So if I ran the world, I'd set those last 38 to 40 men free, and then I would round up Bush, Clinton, Obama, Trump, and Biden and throw all of them in Guantanamo. And then I'd throw away the key. But of course, I don't run the world, nor should I or any other individual run it. But why collectively can't we, the people of America, finally wake up to what our government is doing in our name and say enough? End the military actions in those 159 countries. Bring all of those 173,000 U.S. troops home. And what else should we be doing about Bush, Clinton, Obama, Trump, and Biden? Because you can be damn sure that the U.S. government won't hold any of them to account for their too many to calculate war crimes and imperialist military interventions over the past 20 years. No, it's all up to us. And so what do I think we should do? Well, I think we should hold a series of internet-streamed America's Wars and War Crimes tribunals. In this way, at least, the American people would be made fully aware of the far-flung military actions and war crimes committed in the course of those actions by successive U.S. presidents. Yes, hold these public war and war crimes tribunals. Hear the testimony of the world's leading experts on the laws of warfare and of war crimes. And when we are done, publish the findings widely. It's the very least we can do, friends, unless we want the world to think that we, the American people, as well as our leaders, are happy to have our tax dollars and soldiers police the world and cover it over with the war crimes they have committed in our name. Again, this was Jim Lafferty.
I'm very happy to announce to our listening audience that we have bolstered up our team here. We've got Attorney Jim Lafferty with us as a co-host. Jim was the former executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. For 30 years, he was the director of the Los Angeles chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. He is currently on the board of the Southern California ACLU, and he is the host of the Lawyers Guild show out in Los Angeles. Jim Lafferty, welcome to Law and Disorder as a co-host.
Michael, I couldn't be more pleased to be with you, more proud, frankly, to be joining you and Marjorie Cohn and Heidi Boghossian. Doing this show periodically, as I will be now as a co-host, is a true honor and a true privilege. I have been doing a similar show, as you know, out in Los Angeles at our sister station, so I think we'll have a lot of back and forth, and that'll be good for our listeners and for us as well.
Julian Assange was a young computer genius, an Australian citizen, the publisher of WikiLeaks, and an award-winning journalist and the person responsible for embarrassing the United States by publishing material on American war crimes in Iraq and in Afghanistan. He figured out a way to receive information from whistleblowers and publish that information anonymously in order to protect them. When Mike Pompeo was Trump's director of the CIA, he called WikiLeaks, which was founded by Julian Assange, quote, a hostile non-state intelligence agency, close quote. Pompeo suggested that Julian Assange be kidnapped from the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he had received political asylum, rendered, and then assassinated. What has been the reaction of the major news media to this extraordinary revelation? Will this affect the U.S. government's continued efforts to have him extradited to the United States, where he would be tried for espionage? Assange is presently being held in solitary confinement in London's infamous Belmarsh prison. In earlier developments, Judge Vanessa Beretzer ruled that he could not be extradited to the United States in defiance of the American request because she feared his prison confinement in an American maximum security prison might cause him to commit suicide. Her decision is on appeal by the Biden Justice Department and will be heard by the British High Court on October 26th and 27th. In response to the revelations about Pompeo, Julian's American attorney, Barry Pollack, said that, quote, "The extreme nature of the type of government misconduct that Yahoo News reported would certainly be an issue and potentially grounds for dismissal," end quote. He believes that Assange was targeted by both Trump and Biden, like Nixon had targeted Daniel Ellsberg for his release of the Pentagon Papers during the Vietnam War. In Ellsberg's case, the presiding judge dropped all charges against him. We speak today with Nathan Fuller, who is the executive director of the Courage Foundation and the organization that has been defending Julian Assange in the United States called Assange Defense. Nathan Fuller, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Jim and Michael, for having me.
Yes, Nathan, for years now, supporters of Julian Assange have suspected that the U.S. government would stop at nothing to silence Assange and use him as an example to other brave investigative reporters in order to frighten them into silence when it comes to publishing, as WikiLeaks has done and Julian has done, the truth of Imperial America's illegal wars and war crimes. Our worst fears as to just how far the U.S. would go to silence Assange have been borne out as a result of a just-released bombshell of a news investigative report by Yahoo News. Their investigation, based on conversations with more than 30 former government officials, including CIA officials, have now disclosed a hell of a lot more about the U.S. government's war on WikiLeaks. And most terrifying of all, we now know that, in fact, the U.S. government has explored ways of kidnapping and murdering Julian Assange. Tell us about these shocking, if not unexpected, discoveries and revelations.
I really appreciate you bringing attention to this story, which I am glad to see in an outlet as big as Yahoo News, because it's really incredible. And yes, as you say, Yahoo has revealed the incredible lengths the CIA especially was willing to go to take down Julian Assange if they deemed it necessary. Now, this was largely during the Trump administration. We know that, you know, WikiLeaks has been releasing documents about the U.S. since at least 2010, and it's been an issue for multiple administrations now. But during the Trump administration, the CIA and the White House would go back and forth with plans and ideas for how to deal with Assange from their perspective. And this is largely while he was in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He had received asylum from Ecuador. This is sovereign territory. But the CIA was talking about and drawing up specific plans even to kidnap him and even potentially to assassinate him. Now, the Yahoo story includes that, you know, the CIA has to have a pretext for some of these outrageous things, and their reasoning they give to the White House is that they believe that they say that Russia was attempting to sneak Assange out of the embassy to take him away to safety, you know, just to piss off the U.S., really. So the CIA also had plans for how to deal with that. They said that if Russia snuck him out of the embassy in a car, that they were willing to shoot out the tires of that car. Yes. If he was taken into a plane, they would shoot down the tires of the plane, or even willing to down the plane. And these plans sound kind of incredible or far-fetched, but we should remember in 2013, when Edward Snowden escaped from the U.S. Eventually to Hong Kong and Moscow, the U.S. did down a plane with Evo Morales on board, saying they believed Ed Snowden might have been on board as well. So it's really incredible and worrying. And you're right to point out that this is something we've been talking about and fearing for years. This is the kind of thing that Julian Assange went into the Ecuadorian embassy to protect himself from, and it's why the Ecuadorians gave him asylum. It's truly incredible.
To be clear, Nathan Fuller of the Courage Foundation and the Assange Defense Committee here in the United States, to be clear, in 2017, then-President Donald Trump, in a briefing with the CIA, asked directly whether the CIA could assassinate Assange and asked the CIA to be provided with options for how to do it. Is that correct?
That's correct. The White House and the CIA were going back and forth on this, and actually White House lawyers were worried about how extreme the CIA was getting, but Donald Trump himself did actually ask for that, for these plans to be drawn up. So it's, yeah, they were willing to go to every length to silence the journalist.
Yeah, and I wonder, Nathan, if you could, some of the plans that they had having to do with shooting out tires and what have you, can you give us a sense of the way their plans ran? And also in that regard, Secretary of State Pompeo was very much involved in all of this and apparently was obsessed with WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. So let us know as well about Pompeo's role in this a bit.
Yeah, so this goes actually to when Pompeo was director of the CIA. I mean, we have known, as I said, since 2010, the U.S. government was incensed by WikiLeaks revelations, so the Obama administration impaneled a grand jury. But we also know that in 2013, the Obama administration specifically looked at this, potentially investigating or prosecuting a journalist, and declined to prosecute. But then in 2016, a new administration comes in, new idea of how to treat journalists. Then Attorney General Jeff Sessions said it was a priority to arrest Julian, and a CIA director, Mike Pompeo, made it extremely personal and made clear just how vengeful he was personally. He gave a speech in 2017 to call WikiLeaks a non-state hostile intelligence service. It's a new term for a journalist, but they essentially want to treat a journalism outfit the way they would treat Hezbollah, that kind of thing. So that led to a 2018 resolution that would redefine WikiLeaks in U.S. terminology, but actually two senators on the Senate Intel Committee disagreed with that, Ron Wyden and, surprisingly, Kamala Harris. So that resolution didn't make it out of the committee, but it finally did make its way into a National Defense Authorization Act. Anyway, the point is Pompeo got his terminology, and he got the entire U.S. government, basically. The Yahoo News reports this was the most contentious debate within the Trump administration. So Pompeo and White House were going back and forth on this. This is something that he, even when pushed back by White House lawyers, Pompeo was really aggressive on, and made it just, yeah, a personal, vengeful cause of his.
Nathan, I want to ask you about Vault 7. Vault 7 was apparently a key motivation for the government's desire to murder or otherwise silence Assange. What is or what was Vault 7?
Right, and so WikiLeaks has published documents that expose various crimes over the last decade, but in 2017 they published specifically documents exposing the global capabilities of the CIA, their ability to surveil and hack computer systems around the world. They have, hundreds of malware tools that are secret and that they use on foreign adversaries around the world. And so this is the first time this scope of malware or the capabilities of the CIA had been exposed, running from 2013 to 2016. They were published in 2017, and that's absolutely a part of why the CIA was so embarrassed. They'd never had something this big exposed before, and so they really wanted to get Assange back for that.
Does this mean that the CIA can get into my cell phone or on Alexa or into my computer or any one of those household gadgets that allows you to turn on your washer and dryer? I mean, what exactly can the CIA do now with Vault 7?
It's really just incredible remote capabilities to hack into and to plant malware, spyware, which is to surveil spyware, to surveil malware, to take down, or to otherwise compromise. Yes, absolutely. Your browsers, your smartphones, your anything connected to the internet, basically. It's just an incredible breadth of capabilities.
Nathan Fuller, Julian Assange has been jailed in horrid conditions in England now for some time as the Biden administration, I stress, continues to seek his extradition back to the United States to stand trial in the United States, where, if convicted, he faces 175 years in prison. Now, while there were indeed, after the hearings, many good reasons why the English court should not agree to extradite Assange back to the U.S. so far, they've only ruled in his favor and against extradition based on the court's fear that prison conditions in the United States are such that given Assange's now weakened mental state, he might well kill himself. And the Biden administration is, as we've said, even appealing that ruling. Nathan, a worldwide movement has grown up to defend Julian Assange and freedom of the press. Here in America, the National Defend Assange Committee, which is headed by Noam Chomsky, Alice Walker, and Daniel Ellsberg, is very active with you as its head and daily operative. U.S. journalist Matt Taibbi has said that if the U.S. is successful in extraditing Assange back to the United States, and he is successfully prosecuted, that, quote, will now reserve the right to snatch anyone, anywhere on the planet, who dares to even try to learn about our secret activities, close quote. So, Nathan, what can you say to our listeners who care deeply about freedom of the press? What can they do to help pressure the Biden administration to drop its attempt to bring Assange back to the United States for this bogus trial or worse?
Yes, I want to address two parts of that, if I could, first.
Sure.
Just to say, first, we've been talking a lot about 2017 and Vault 7 and other things that have happened in the last several years, but it's really important listeners know that the U.S. prosecution and indictment of Assange is all about 2010. It's all about documents that WikiLeaks released in 2010 exposing war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay, and these State Department cables. Nothing to do with any 2016 DNC releases or 2017 Vault 7. Those are not in the charges. So this is
exactly
purely for obtaining and publishing, you know, truthful information in the public interest that, you know, we absolutely deserve to know about. And so people should know that this is basic journalism that the New York Times and the Washington Post have exercised and engaged in as well. And so and that's why people are really worrying and warning that this prosecution threatens press freedom around the country. But as Taibbi says, it's also around the world. Assange is an Australian citizen. He was working in Europe at the time. The U.S. is attempting to say that they can prosecute anyone around the world. And if you just use any counterexample, you should see how extreme that is. You know, what if a foreign country decided just to pick up a U.S. journalist and imprison them for writing about their government? It's just really an incredible reach. So we absolutely should not let it come to the United States. The U.S. wants to extradite Assange from the U.K. to the U.S., but it's not by any means a foregone conclusion or a done deal. In the last days of the Trump administration, Trump did appeal that ruling, but we're calling on Biden, and specifically Biden's Attorney General Merrick Garland, to have a new look at this case and see that it's an incredible threat to the First Amendment that needs to be stopped. So absolutely, people should come join the Assange Defense Committee. They should come to assangedefense.org and get in touch. And we're organizing events around the country and, raising awareness for this.
And Nathan Fuller, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time, unfortunately. But I wanted to ask you to please repeat the website that our listeners can hit on. And then I want to ask you one last question. What is the website?
Sure. Just assangedefense.org. That's where you can find information about upcoming events, the legal updates in Julian's case, and how to get involved and get in touch with us.
Last question, Nathan. I understand that there's going to be an appeal heard on Julian's case. What's that all about?
So that's actually October 27th and 28th in London. The U.S. lost its extradition case in London, but is appealing that decision to the U.K.'s High Court. So they lost at the district level. They're now appealing to the High Court. And that hearing is going to take place October 27th and 28th in London, and we'll be covering it at assangedefense.org.
Nathan Fuller, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Last week, tens of thousands of women demonstrated all over the country in support of a woman's right to choose. The demonstrations took place just 1 month after Texas had enacted its infamous heartbeat law, which is nearly a total ban on abortions. It prohibits abortion after a woman is 6 weeks pregnant, when most women don't even know they're pregnant. Currently, the law established by Roe v. Wade in 1973 defends women and affords them the right to get an abortion in the first two trimesters of their pregnancies, that is, between 22 and 24 weeks. One in four women in the United States of America has had an abortion. The first thing that the fascist Hitler government did in Germany in 1933 when it came to power was to lock up all the family planning clinics. They believed women need to be controlled. Women needed to be controlled, and women should be put in their home, in the kitchen, or in the church. That was Hitler's slogan. Anti-abortion laws disproportionately attack black women, brown women, and poor women. The Women's Health Protection Act, which would codify Roe v. Wade, has passed the House and is now in the Senate, where it likely will lose. Coming up before the Supreme Court is the Jackson Women's Health Care case, which originated in Mississippi. That state passed a law limiting abortion to the first 15 weeks of pregnancy. It is the first direct challenge to Roe v. Wade. Five reactionary anti-abortion Catholics sit on the Supreme Court, as well as an anti-abortion fundamentalist Christian. We speak today with our own Marjorie Cohn, who has recently written two articles in Truthout on women's rights to choose.
Marjorie, last month, in allowing the outrageously restrictive Texas anti-abortion law to go into effect, most observers of the Supreme Court are now convinced that when the court, this term, takes up the Mississippi anti-abortion law in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, they will overrule, or essentially overrule, Roe v. Wade. Do you agree with that assessment?
I'm afraid that might happen, Jim. Let me just give you a little background. Roe v. Wade, a 1973 case, established the constitutional right to an abortion until the fetus is viable. Generally, that's 22 to 24 weeks. And in 1992, in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the Supreme Court said that states may not place an undue burden on a woman's right to choose an abortion before fetal viability. Now, you mentioned the SB 8 case in Texas, Whole Woman's Health versus Jackson. And in that case, Texas established a law that prohibits abortion after there is some cardiac activity detected, which is about 6 weeks before most people know that they're pregnant. The federal district court wanted to hold a hearing on the constitutionality of SB 8 because it goes directly against Roe v. Wade, outlawing abortion after 6 weeks instead of 22 to 24 weeks. And the appellate court put a halt to that hearing, and the case went up to the Supreme Court. And instead of waiting until the case went through the normal procedure of going to the district court, going to the appellate court, having briefing, having oral arguments, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision on what's called the shadow docket, because they do it without being out in the open about it, they allowed SB 8 to go into effect, effectively cutting off the right to abortion to women in Texas. And women in Texas have virtually been deprived of getting abortions since that decision came down. And it was the radical right-wingers, the ultra-conservatives on the court, who ruled that SB 8 could go into effect. Now, Chief Justice John Roberts, who is also a conservative, voted with the liberals to go through the briefing process, see what the lower court said. He is concerned about the legitimacy of his court because he knew that this is clearly opposed to Roe v. Wade and it should go through the normal process. In the Texas case, on September the 9th, the Department of Justice filed a separate lawsuit challenging the Texas law on federal grounds. And on October 6th, in a stunning decision, 113-page opinion, U.S. District Judge Robert Pittman struck down SB 8 and said that it should not go into effect. He put an injunction on all lawsuits to hold doctors accountable and those who aid and abet them accountable for violating SB 8. And he forbade state judges and clerks from accepting or docketing those cases. And finally, Judge Pittman ordered Texas to publish this preliminary injunction on all of its public-facing court websites with a visible, easy-to-understand instruction to the public that SB 8 lawsuits will not be accepted by Texas courts. Now, the state of Texas asked for an immediate stay or pause of this injunction. They wanted to go ahead with SB 8 and allow lawsuits punishing doctors and people who aided and abetted them in women getting abortions after 6 weeks. And what Pittman said in his denial of Texas's request for a stay of his decision was, quote, "The state has forfeited the right to any such accommodation by pursuing an unprecedented and aggressive scheme to deprive its citizens of a significant and well-established constitutional right." Now, keep in mind that if Pittman's decision is eventually overturned in the conservative Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which it very well might be, doctors who perform abortions in the interim can still be sued. And outlawing abortion is not going to prevent abortion. It will prevent safe abortions. And poor, rural, undocumented, and non-white women in Texas are those who are most directly harmed. Women who have money, who can go to other states to get abortions, will not feel the pinch so severely. And there, besides Texas, a dozen other states have passed legislation prohibiting abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy, but federal judges have blocked those laws because they conflict with Roe v. Wade. And 11 states have enacted so-called trigger laws, which would ban all or almost all abortions if Roe v. Wade is overturned. Okay, fast forward to the Mississippi case, which is going to be heard by the Supreme Court on December 1st. In 2018, Mississippi passed what is called the Gestational Age Act. Two federal courts have blocked it because it violates Roe v. Wade. But in this Mississippi law, it only allows abortions after 15 weeks in medical emergencies or severe fetal abnormality. It has no exceptions for rape or incest. And so if doctors perform abortions outside of those parameters, they can have their medical licenses suspended or revoked and be subject to penalties and fines. The Jackson Women's Health Organization, which is the only licensed abortion provider in Mississippi, went to court to try to stop this law, this Gestational Age Act, and a federal district court, that's the trial court in the federal system, agreed with the clinic that it violated Roe v. Wade. But the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit upheld that decision and rejected Mississippi's argument that the Supreme Court cases required the district court to determine instead whether the law creates a substantial obstacle for a person seeking an abortion before the fetus becomes viable. Now, the state of Mississippi went to the Supreme Court and asked the justices to rule on whether all bans on pre-viability abortions are unconstitutional. In other words, the state of Mississippi is asking the Supreme Court squarely to overrule Roe v. Wade. This is the first time that question has been put directly to the justices, and Mississippi knows that there is a majority, a supermajority of radical ultra-conservatives on the Supreme Court who are opposed to abortion, who might and very well might take kindly to overruling Roe v. Wade. Mississippi is also asking the justices to decide whether courts should consider a state's interests, such as protecting the health of the fetus or the mother, when reviewing the constitutionality of laws that restrict pre-viability abortions. And Mississippi is asking the Supreme Court whether abortion providers have a legal right to challenge laws that ban or restrict abortions on behalf of their patients. So, unfortunately, and I wish I had a better prediction here, given the fact that five members of the Supreme Court were so quick to allow Texas to ban all abortions after 6 weeks, with no lower courts weighing in, with no briefing, with no oral argument, that does not bode well for the viability of Roe versus Wade, and we'll have a better idea, although you can't tell for sure during oral argument, but we will have somewhat of a better idea from the questioning by the justices on December 1st. They will issue their opinion in the Mississippi case by the end of June, which is the end of the Supreme Court term that just began.
Marjorie, assuming for a moment that Roe is not simply undermined by some halfway decision, that in fact it is effectively or specifically overruled, that leaves the matter of abortion, does it not, to each state. Based on what we've seen so far, and you've referenced many of these restrictive laws already on the books in so many states, does that not in fact portend a period of time in America when women are going to be in desperate straits to receive an abortion?
Absolutely, Jim. It would initially kick the question of whether or not abortion is lawful to the states, but the anti-choice movement invariably will quickly organize attempts to outlaw abortion nationwide. And of course, it depends upon what the Supreme Court says in its decision. If it says that Roe v. Wade is unconstitutional, then it may prevent states from keeping abortion legal. So it really depends upon how that decision is framed.
At any rate, a frightening moment coming, and you said in early December?
End of June is in all likelihood when the decision will come down, because the Supreme Court has a tendency to announce its decisions in the most controversial cases at the end of its term. And there is no doubt that this is perhaps the most controversial case on its docket this term.
Indeed. Well, thank you, Marjorie, for that wonderful summary so far. Michael, I know you have some questions as well, my friend.
Marjorie, I remember when JFK, John Kennedy, was running for president in 1960, and he was a Catholic, and he was asked, is your religion going to have anything to do in impacting your decisions? And he said, absolutely not. But what strikes me is that a number of the Supreme Court justices who are anti-abortion are Catholics. And does this go against what Kennedy articulated in his idea of separation of church and state?
Well, it certainly does, Michael. Not all Catholics on the Supreme Court are anti-choice, anti-abortion. Sonia Sotomayor is also Catholic. But, for example, Amy Coney Barrett, the newest member of the court, has made it clear that she is anti-abortion, anti-choice. She criticized Chief Justice John Roberts for voting with the liberals to uphold or to strike down a Louisiana law that made it very difficult for women to get abortions. And Chief Justice Roberts was relying on a recent prior decision of the Supreme Court with the identical issue in a Texas case, and he said stare decisis, which is the precedent that they're bound to follow, required them to strike down the Louisiana law as well. And when Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that opinion, he was criticized, I believe, by Justice Barrett. So if these justices cannot separate their personal views, many of which come from their religion, from their decision-making, then we are in very, very bad shape.
I have a follow-up question, Marjorie. What organizations are behind the anti-abortion movement, and where does the money come from?
Well, there are a number of organizations, the so-called Texas Right to Life is one of them, and I say that advisedly because I don't use that term, pro-lifers. I think pro-lifers are not just concerned with a fetus that might be 6 weeks old, but if you're really a right-to-lifer, you should be concerned with children once they are actually born and giving them health care and giving them education and providing for their needs. But there are many other organizations as well that are funding and financing this campaign to get Roe v. Wade overturned. And interestingly, this Texas Right to Life had a website basically inviting whistleblowers to snitch on people, women who were getting abortions after 6 weeks, and encouraging lawsuits against doctors and people who aided and abetted these women, such as Uber drivers, family members, clergy, etc. And the GoDaddy shut down that website, saying that it interfered with the personal right to privacy. And I think that Texas Right to Life is having a hard time getting a server for its website, its so-called whistleblower website, so that people can snitch on women who are getting abortions after 6 weeks in Texas.
Marjorie, I have a follow-up question as well. Assuming that from our point of view, the worst happens and Roe versus Wade is overturned, that seems to lend some credence to the fact that perhaps the Supreme Court should be expanded in terms of its numbers. There's nothing that specifically says the court has to have 9 members. A number of political people around the country, because of the ever more conservative, the fact that Trump got 3 appointments to the Supreme Court and the ever more conservative opinions coming out of it, not just on abortion, but on so many issues, that perhaps now it is reasonable to expand the court and thereby give Biden an opportunity to perhaps make some appointments. But what is your position in general about the notion of expanding the court? And should a decision as profound as Roe v. Wade balance that argument one way or the other?
The number of justices on the Supreme Court is not set in the Constitution. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt tried to expand the number of justices on the court. It was called court packing because there was a 5-4 right-wing majority on the Supreme Court that was striking down his New Deal legislation. And eventually, the 5th vote changed, so it was 5-4 to uphold the New Deal legislation, and the court number of justices was never expanded. And some people say that FDR lost the battle but won the war. The number of justices on the Supreme Court have varied over the years, and there's nothing magic about 9 justices. It certainly could be expanded to, say, 13. Whether that would happen or not, I think it's highly unlikely given the political situation that we're facing now. And in terms of term limits, I think it would be a good idea, instead of having a lifetime appointment, to have, say, an 18-year term, which allows for continuity, but also provides a cutoff. Now, that would require a constitutional amendment, and amending the Constitution is like moving heaven and earth. So I think that while those are both good suggestions, neither one has much of a chance of being enacted in the near future.
A story much in the news these days, and of particular interest not only to attorneys, but those who believe in civil rights and the rule of law, is the Stephen Danziger case, which involves, he is a human rights attorney who's been sentenced to prison after winning a major case against Chevron, an environmental case against Chevron. The judge in that case has behaved in ways which has outraged many, many in the legal profession and otherwise in this country today. Let our listeners know who Stephen Danziger is and what this case is all about.
Well, Stephen Danziger is a human rights lawyer who has spent over 2 decades trying to hold Chevron accountable for pollution of the Ecuadorian rainforest. In 2000, Chevron acquired Texaco, which had contaminated the water and soil in Ecuador's Lago Agrio region between 1964 and 1992. And Lago Agrio is the ancestral homeland of more than 30,000 people. Texaco deliberately drained its toxic waste into rivers and streams whose water was critical to the survival of five indigenous groups and dozens of farm communities. So Texas created what is known as the Amazon Chernobyl. In 2011, an Ecuadorian court found Chevron liable for serious environmental and health damage to the Amazon rainforest and the communities in the region, and Chevron was ordered to pay $19 billion. That was reduced on appeal to $9.5 billion. But federal judge Lewis Kaplan in the United States has manipulated this case in ways that are really unethical under the canons of judicial ethics, and has basically ruled after a so-called hearing on a RICO case, racketeering case that he encouraged the prosecutor to bring. He said that that $9.5 billion cannot be collected. Now, during these proceedings, Stephen Donziger was ordered at Chevron's request to turn over his confidential communications, electronic communications, to Chevron, so Chevron could review what he was discussing with his client, his trial strategy, highly unethical. But this Judge Kaplan, who is very pro-Chevron and has ties to Chevron, held him in contempt. And he actually appointed, hand-picked, another pro-Chevron judge, Loretta Preska, a U.S. District Court judge, who is a leader of the Federalist Society, which is a group dedicated to getting conservatives on the bench and promoting a radical right-wing ideology. And the Federalist Society is also financially backed by Chevron. So Judge Kaplan handpicked Judge Preska to try the contempt case, and she found Donziger guilty of six counts of criminal contempt. And in a move calculated to shield Chevron and deter other human rights lawyers from suing giant corporate polluters, Donziger was sentenced on October 1st by Preska to the maximum of 6 months in prison for criminal contempt. Contempt because he refused to hand over his confidential attorney-client communications to Chevron. Before his sentencing, Donziger had spent 2 years on house arrest, wearing an ankle bracelet and confined to his home. Donziger is the only lawyer who has been held in contempt for trying to appeal orders which he believed violated the rights of his clients to enforce the judgment. And Ron Kuby, who is Donziger's lawyer, told me in an article I was writing for Truthout after the sentencing, quote, "When the next book is written touting the American judicial system as one built on the rule of law that shows the ways in which the rule of law prevailed over powerful and moneyed interests, I can assure you the Donziger case will not be included." Now, another very, very significant development 2 weeks before the sentencing was the UN Human Rights Council's Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, which found that Donziger's 2-year house arrest constituted unlawful arbitrary detention under international law and recommended his immediate release with compensation and reparations. And the panel of five prominent jurists noted that the, quote, extraordinary criminal contempt charges that led to Donziger's detention stemmed from his refusal to surrender devices that would give Chevron near wholesale access to confidential, privileged, and protected documents in a way that would have compromised his ability to provide legal assistance to the people he was defending, which would have posed a great risk to their lives. That panel wrote they were appalled by the allegations in the case. They said that the charges against Danziger and his detention appear to be retaliation for his work as a legal representative of indigenous communities, and that he was unlawfully targeted because he's a human rights defender. He was punished for upholding his professional duty. And also, the panel said that the protocol created by Judge Kaplan to collect, copy, and examine Danziger's electronic devices did not provide safeguards to protect confidential information about his indigenous clients, including core litigation strategies to collect their $9.5 billion judgment against Chevron around the world. And finally, this panel from the UN Human Rights Council said that Judge Kaplan demonstrated a staggering display of lack of objectivity and impartiality and resulted in a denial of Danziger's right to a fair trial under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is a treaty the U.S. ratified, making it part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution.
Marjorie Cohn, what was your reaction when Judge Preska was about to sentence Steve Danziger, and she said to him, what we need to do is hit you between the eyes with the proverbial 2x4 so that you'll get some respect for the law?
Yes, as Preska was sentencing Danziger, she stated, quote, "It seems that only the proverbial 2x4 between the eyes will instill in him any respect for the law," unquote. To me, Jim, that sounded like a threat. A federal court judge talking about hitting a person that she is sentencing with a 2x4 between the eyes, which revealed even more strongly her anti-human rights and pro-Chevron bias. I also asked Danziger's other attorney, Martin Garbus, who was interviewed on Law and Disorder recently, for his reaction to the judge's six-month sentence and those threatening words that Prescott uttered. And Garbus replied, quote, "Outrageous, predictable, very sad," unquote.
Marjorie, are you optimistic that as the Danziger matter goes up on appeal and the other issues in the case go up on appeal, that we can expect a more just outcome other than the outrageous kangaroo court decisions and outcome that have abided so far?
Well, I certainly hope so. Danziger has filed an appeal, although he asked for bond pending appeal. This is a misdemeanor he's been convicted of, misdemeanor contempt. And Judge Preska, for showing her bias once again, denied him bail pending appeal and said he had to stay under house arrest, can't leave his house, has to wear an ankle bracelet. But I am hopeful that when his appeal is eventually heard by the Court of Appeals, that they will reverse this outrageous decision of Preska's, and we'll see what happens. But hopefully they don't have the same pro-Chevron bias that Judges Kaplan and Preska demonstrated so clearly during these proceedings.
And just quickly, there's a wide movement now around this country and beyond to defend Danziger. Do you happen to know, Marjorie, I confess I don't have it in front of me as I should, what website or where people could go if they want to be a part of the effort to protest and defend Danziger?
Yes, people can go to danzigerdefense.com to get more information about how to support this very, very important struggle.
And very, very important attorney, and too, and a human rights attorney. Thank you, Marjorie, so much for that. And I encourage, frankly, all of our listeners to follow that advice, go to that website, and become part of the effort to correct this grave injustice, not only to the people represented by Mr. Danziger, but to Attorney Danziger himself.
Well, Marjorie Cohn, Jim Lafferty, unfortunately, we've come to an end of our allotted time here. We want to thank you, Marjorie. Thank you very much for your explaining this to us. And it's been nice talking with you and nice working with you, Jim Lafferty. Until next week, I want to say goodbye.
Goodbye, all.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. We'll be right back.